Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Let's say things are going well. Okay, now imagine how great they would be if you just added some green. For St. Paddy's Day, an exploration of how adding green to anything, the Chicago River, a McDonald's milkshake, beer, makes it better. Going green the old-fashioned way. Happy Green Day. I'm The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Did you know that? Al Green, Irish guy. Huh? Did you know that?
I noticed with all that talk of green, you are not wearing any.
I know. I never do. It's Wednesday, March 17th. Happy St. Paddy's Day, everyone.
Let's get right to the top news this morning. It's the big question on Capitol Hill this week. Will House Democrats have enough votes to pass health care reform? House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer told ABC News last hour.
On every major piece of legislation we passed over the last year, the press was right up at the last minute. Do you have the votes? Do you have the votes? We said we think we do, and yes, we did. We think we'll have the votes when the roll is called.
At this time, Democrats still appear to be short of the 216 votes they need. A vote is expected on Friday or Saturday. The FBI says hitmen may have gone to the wrong party and killed the wrong people in the Mexican city of Juarez last weekend. Three people with ties to the U.S. embassy were killed in the drive-by shooting. We're learning this morning the FBI says there's no evidence the victims were targeted because they were employed at the consulate. This Juarez residents tells the BBC.
It's kind of sad, too, because, you know, people that got killed or carjacking, you know, all those kind of things. It's kind of sad and frightening.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon visited Juarez yesterday.
It could throw a wrench in the U.S. census. Some religious leaders are telling undocumented immigrants not to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera is the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches.
How in the world are we going to ask undocumented immigrants to trust and to open the door where they have no assurances that that information will be confidential? I will not be used against them.
Census officials and other religious leaders say a boycott is counterproductive. In the Middle East, Israel has lifted its closure on the occupied West Bank this morning. It comes as the U.S. and Israel are trying to step back from their deepest rift in decades. The BBC's Heather Sharp joined us earlier this morning and told us about the mood in Jerusalem.
I think what we saw yesterday, we saw clashes on the streets, was a sign that the Palestinians are becoming more and more frustrated. And if you speak to them, they don't have much positive to say about the efforts to restart the peace process. I'm not even going to call it a peace process because essentially there isn't one. On the Israeli side, there's a bit more difference in opinion. Some Israelis think if we want a two-state solution, we really need to move on because demographically we need to have some kind of solution that prevents there being essentially a Palestinian majority in a wider state, one state. They want to divide it to have two states. But on the other hand, there are people who do quite strongly support the strong line that Benjamin Netanyahu has taken on security.
You can hear it there, lack of clarity in Israel. We're going to explore the stalemate in the Middle East with Heather Sharp and an Israeli expert in just a few minutes. The number of people in state prisons has dropped for the first time in nearly 40 years. It's a small decrease, with the Pew Center report putting the drop at just 0.4%. California and Michigan saw the biggest decline. 1.5 million inmates in state prisons across the nation. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,685. The S&P opens at 1,159. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. Happy St. Paddy's Day. Since we talk about food every Wednesday, think of green foods, won't you? And figure out which
salad
one we pick later on. Salad is one.
Asparagus.
Asparagus is one.
Big fan of artichokes. We're also talking about do-it-yourself. Do-it-yourself financial bailouts. Before you can do that, though, you have to be able to talk about money. And as it turns out, we have trouble talking about money. We're embarrassed. We feel bad. We don't want to talk about it. What is taboo for you to talk about it when it comes to money? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or let us know on thetakeaway.org.
Money is green.
It is. That's true.
Your You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We begin in the Middle East, and you know something's up when New York Times columnist and former Middle East reporter Tom Friedman compares the Israeli government to a drunk driver, which he did, referring to that very awkward visit by Vice President Joseph Biden last week to Israel. That trip had all sorts of problems, but we really are looking at a pattern now, a combination of ill-timed statements on settlements in the occupied territories. When the vice president was in Jerusalem, there were some scattered demonstrations we've been hearing about this week, and a widespread perception that the entire peace process has ground to an ill-mannered halt. It's really raised fears throughout the region that the current stalemate, or maybe it's not a stalemate, but whatever is going on right now might quickly be replaced by something much worse. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, speaking yesterday, tried to make a virtue out of disagreement.
We are both committed to a two-state solution, but that doesn't mean that we're going to agree. We don't agree with any of our international partners on everything.
But disagreements between the U.S. and Israel have been described as the worst crisis between the two nations in years. Is this a turning point or just a standard issue stalemate in the peace process? We were joined earlier by Heather Sharp, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem, and by Dr. Ilan Peleg, a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He's the Charles A. Dana Professor of Government and Law at Lafayette College, and he's also editor-in-chief of the journal Israel Studies Forum. I began by asking Dr. Peleg whether the current flare-up could be considered a real crisis in U.S.-Israel relations.
Yes, I think it is a crisis of a sort. I think it goes beyond being an irritant. And I think that you do have to take an historical view of it and realize that you had in the past those kind of crises in the relationship between Israel and the United States. For example, going back all the way to 1956-57, you had the crisis between the Eisenhower administration and the Israeli government following the Sinai campaign. You later on had in 1975 the crisis between the Ford and Kissinger administration and the first Rabin government, known as the reassessment. You had several of those crises in the relationship between Jimmy Carter and the Israeli government
Indeed.
In the 1970s, and I think that this one is one of those disagreements that are quite sharp.
Dr. Ilan Peleg is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He's on the line with us from Pennsylvania. Heather Sharp is also with us, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. How are the Israeli media playing this particular crisis? Are they reminiscing about the 70s? Is this a period that is demoralizing to Israelis? You described a little bit of the reaction earlier.
I think there are certainly people in Israel who are very, very worried about the relationship. There are editorials suggesting that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is kind of spectacularly mismanaging this relationship, which is so important to Israel. And it's a time when, for example, we've got the Goldstone report at the UN, when Israel is feeling its need for support in the international community. But equally, there are people who are enraged and who think that the Obama administration has taken quite a strongly anti-Israel line. For example, he's not even visited here. One of his big set-piece speeches in the beginning was a visit to Cairo. He hasn't been as president yet to Jerusalem. So there are some people that think that they're just pushing it a bit far.
Is the administration's focus on the Arab and Islamic world something that has enhanced the political divisions in Israel and is partly perhaps what we're seeing as a consequence of that?
Well, Israel has wide divisions, full stop. And I think perhaps one of the things that's coming out of this is where everybody really sits. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu is in a right-leaning coalition. He has some really quite far right-wing partners. And I think in a sense, this crisis is kind of pushing him to choose, is he going to continue to stick to the similar kind of line that will go down okay with them, that will keep the coalition together? Or is he going to have to yield in some sense to the pressure from the American administration, which has made it very clear that it wants serious final status negotiations? And I mean, the tension we've seen recently is largely over Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is, you know, a kind of very central example of the difference between them. For the Palestinians to come and engage in final status negotiations, they need to feel that Jerusalem is at least on the table.
Right.
Benjamin Netanyahu makes it clear he sees the city as Jerusalem's eternal undivided capital.
Heather Sharp, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Ilan Peleg, let's talk a little bit more broadly. I mean, the discussions over the last couple of weeks have been about settlements in East Jerusalem, but I'm wondering, based on what Heather Sharp is saying there, is it possible for Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, to deliver any significant breakthrough on the order of what Ariel Sharon might have been capable of doing before he, of course, had his terrible stroke and was out of commission?
Yes, I definitely think it is. I think that he's basically facing the same kind of choice that Helen was talking about, and that indeed Netanyahu himself had to face in the late 1990s when he was prime minister. In other words, on the one hand, he has his commitment to his ideology and indeed the commitment to the structure of his right-wing coalition. On the other hand, he has enormous amount of international pressure, particularly American pressures, and indeed some kind of an international consensus even on the final shape of the settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. So I think that he is really in the hot seat and has to make a choice, and it remains to be seen exactly how he's going to move along.
But Israeli governments have mistimed this in the past, allowing the clock to run out on the Palestinian side and everything dissolves into violence. I mean, that seems to be the big worry here before we go.
Yes, I think that, in fact, you have both governments mishandling very often their commitments. So I think most of the scholarly scholarly community would look at the situation as both sides and not having kept their commitment according to previous peace settlements.
That's Dr. Ilan Peleg, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute and editor-in-chief of the journal Israel Studies Forum. We also spoke with the BBC's Heather Sharp earlier this morning. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
Just within the past few minutes, we've discovered the Associated Press reports five young Americans being held in Pakistan have been charged with planning terror attacks. The five are from the Washington, D.C. area. We'll bring you more details about the story as we get them. News out of Haiti this morning, aid workers are reporting an increase in the number of sexual assaults in the tent camps, the tent cities for the homeless. Women and children are falling victim to rapists in the sprawling tent cities set up for earthquake victims. Allison Thompson is a volunteer medical worker.
When the lights go down, that's when the rapes increase. And it's happening daily across all the camps in POP. And a lot of them end up in my hospital, children as young as 2 years old.
Thompson says there aren't enough police to provide adequate security for the thousands of camp dwellers.
Here in the U.S., Detroit has produced a plan for the closure of 45 schools in the next 5 years. The city says it's a roadmap to fix the city's failing school system. Earlier, we spoke to Noah Ovshinsky from our member station WDET in Detroit.
If you're the district, it means you're saving a lot of money. This $31 million alone, if they close the full 45 buildings this year.
Also, reports this morning say a Chicago man accused of preparing targets for the 2008 Mumbai attacks plans to change his plea to guilty. David Coleman Headley will appear in court tomorrow. He pleaded not guilty in January to charges including conspiracy to carry out bomb attacks in India. To look at some of the stories we're watching this morning, coming up, the census and its strange categories.
Didn't know that blacks or African Americans would still be categorized as Negroes.
What do you think about the census? We'll talk categories in a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on stories that we're following this week. And the big one is healthcare, which is supposedly in its endgame stage. But Capitol Hill is now embroiled in a debate over procedure.
They're already uneasy about the way this is playing out. Now you're saying it's going to be this Byzantine procedural rule that nobody understands. You lose the trust of the public at some point. This bill's too big to do it that way.
That's Democratic Congressman Jason Altmaier of Pennsylvania. You lose the trust of the public at some point. I think we may have passed that point already. But right now, the argument is not over the health care bill at this moment. It's over how we get it done. There are those who want a decision and don't care how it happens. To explain, we've got our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So the latest is we're hearing, okay, first of all, we now know as the American public more about reconciliation as a procedure in Washington than anybody ever probably wanted to know.
Right.
But the Byzantine procedure that Jason Altmaier is talking about is not reconciliation. This is a bizarre rule that's going to allow them possibly to pass the health care bill in the House without voting on it. How does that work?
Well, that's right. Reconciliation's involved, but only tangentially. So another twist in this gnarled vine of rules here. Every bill, Celeste, that comes to the House floor comes with what's called a rule. And a rule goes through the gatekeeper of the House Rules Committee. And a rule just says, here's how many hours you get for this debate. Here's how many amendments you get. And then we're going to vote on passing the bill. And every bill that comes to the floor has a rule that governs that. Well, what Democrats are considering having here is a rule that says once the House votes on this rule, the House will approve the rule. The Senate bill, which a lot of Democrats don't want to vote for a lot of reasons, once they vote on this rule, the Senate bill is automatically passed. Poof. Just like that. You pass the rule, the bill is passed. Another thing they might do, a variation on this, have a rule that says once they vote on the reconciliation package of fixes, which they also have to vote on, which is popular, a lot of people want to support it, hey, once you vote on the reconciliation package, poof, Senate bill, passed automatically, without having to actually cast a vote on that Senate bill. That's what they're considering doing, and that's why Democrats like Jason Altmaier, who you just heard from, don't like it. Now, not all Democrats don't like it, but he's one Democrat who doesn't. Frankly, he didn't vote for it the first time, so why would he like it this time?
Well, some Democrats, as I understand, are privately saying that this would be a way for them to vote for the bill without actually having to go on record.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's sort of the point. Listen to Lynn Woolsey. She's a progressive Democrat from California. She's for this bill, sort of articulating that yes, we just have to get this done, and protecting Democrats from what's potentially an unpopular vote is okay. Listen to Woolsey.
I can tell you that my constituents aren't going to fault me for taking a step that has to be taken in order to get the Senate bill fixed if we have to vote for it first.
It sounds to me like there's just kind of an acknowledgement that the American public just wants this to be done, one way or the other, right?
Well,
they want this debate to be over.
And that's what a lot of the progressives say. And they frankly say, look, this has been hard enough. There's a lot of stuff in that Senate bill, you know, special deals for Nebraska that are going to come out anyway. But they don't want to have to cast a vote for it because they know what the 30-second ad is going to look like. Celeste Headlee voted for special deals, even though it'll never be in the final bill. So they just don't want to deal with that stuff. And they don't want to vote for a bill that's going to do that to them. So they're looking for a way to be shielded. The House Democratic leadership hasn't made a final decision on this gnarled procedure that we're talking about, but they're leaning towards it because without it, Celeste, it's possible they don't have the votes.
All right. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
I'm thinking about that gnarled vine of rules there, Todd talked about. Our next guest is Tim Olson. He's the Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. He runs the Bureau's outreach campaign nationwide. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Great. We asked you on the program because we have a few questions about the categories that you see in the questionnaire there on the census, and all of you playing at home can bring up that questionnaire on the internet if you just go to the census or Google the census. But here's a question somebody had.
This is Michelle calling from Atlanta. Got my census information. It was a little unclear. I didn't know that blacks or African Americans would still be categorized as Negroes. Just kind of disturbed me. What's up with that?
What's up with that, Tim Olson?
we've heard this from many people. It's Negro is just part of the overall category on the form. This is black, African American, or Negro. It's just a broad category that people can check off. It's really, when you look back at Census 2000, more than 50,000 people actually wrote in Negro.
Interesting.
And it was one option. Then we continued that for 2010. And if people are upset this time, the best thing I can say is just be sure to check off the race that best fits them. and 2020, it might be different.
Well, figuring out a name to call yourself is also an issue with same-sex couples or heterosexual married couples, and this is the first time the census is actually going to count gay couples, even though they don't have a category called gay couples, right?
Correct.
How does that work?
What'll happen is on every form, there's a person one, and then if there's more than one person in the household, those additional people will identify how they're related to person one. So if you have a household, two people, let's say two women, and person two says that they are related to person one, either as a married partner or as an unmarried partner, husband, wife, or unmarried partner, we will be able to actually tabulate that data and show how many same-sex couples there are in the United States.
In 2000, how many did you count?
1.2 million.
And they were in 97% of all counties within the United States. That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, you can't tell roomies from actual same-sex couples, though, right?
Correct. I mean, roommates is one of the categories on the form. Boarders, children, grandparents. There's many options for how people can be related to person one.
And I just love how interesting it is that every 10 years you have to re-examine the categories. Tim Olson, Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. If you are preparing your NCAA brackets, maybe you're joining your office pool, maybe you know nothing about basketball, maybe you know too much.
You're under arrest because it's illegal. Okay?
I didn't say they were putting in money.
All right. Good.
It could just be a polite, friendly competition.
Illegal gambling.
We've got tips for you on how to win your illegal gambling office pool.
Under arrest.
In just a few moments. Here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The final showdown over health care could be coming at the end of this week. We're learning this morning, even if Democrats don't get the votes, they might try another way to pass the bill. It's an arcane procedure where the Senate bill would be deemed to have passed if House members voted in favor of a separate bill that had health care provisions attached. Republicans say Democrats shouldn't use such a parliamentary detour with a bill of this magnitude, but House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer had this to say on ABC News this morning.
Unfortunately, the Republicans are a little bit like the boy who killed his two parents and then wants sympathy because they're an orphan.
Ouch. A House vote is expected on Friday or Saturday. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is trying to curb the abuse of painkillers by soldiers. Military doctors wrote almost 4 million prescriptions for painkillers last year. That's more than four times the doses handed out in 2001, although officials say that's because that of the continuing toll of fighting two major wars.
So prescription drugs were the target of a major heist in Enfield, Connecticut that looked like the Navy SEALs might have carried out. This hour we spoke to an Eli Lilly spokesman who told us it was a well-thought-out, brazen crime.
They tore a hole in the roof of the facility. They rappelled down to the floor, where they then proceeded to take several dozen pallets of pharmaceutical products, load them onto a waiting truck, and then depart.
$75 million worth of medication, one of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history. Checking the markets now, Asian and European markets up. Futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,685. The S&P opens at 1,159. The NASDAQ at 2,378. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it's the middle of March. For many people, that means spring. Tulips begin to break through the soil. For other people, it means St. Patrick's Day, green beer. And for others, it means March Madness.
This year, we watched every game, read box scores, tracked injuries. This isn't March Madness. This is March meticulously thought outness.
Your team lost 20 minutes ago.
That is from CBS's How I Met Your Mother. And like the people on the show, many people, both guessers and strategists, were going to be soon handing in their filled-out brackets for the NCAA men's basketball tournament. The tournament kicks off tomorrow at 12:20 Eastern with BYU versus Florida. Lots of people are flocking to Las Vegas, though, not to see a game, but because it's illegal to gamble in your office pool. Illegal, my friends. But if you need some tips on how to fill out that bracket, we're joined now by Dan Shanoff, a freelance sports writer and a contributor to sportingnews.com and the Wall Street Journal. Also, Mike Hyland joins us. He's an engineer, and he's actually headed to Las Vegas tonight for his annual pilgrimage in honor of March Madness. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Mike, not a very good line for you as you are getting ready to preparing to head off to Las Vegas, but you make an annual trip to Las Vegas, and as I understand, you crunch numbers obsessively, stare at boards until you get your brackets filled out and you're ready to gamble on your Sweet 16 and Final Four picks.
Yeah, sure. For about the last 12 years, we've been heading to Las Vegas, a group of my college buddies and I. The brackets are being filled out, you know, a couple of days beforehand for all your office pools and friend pools. And then once you arrive in Vegas, really you're sitting in front of these 20-foot projection televisions watching four games at once, betting on between, you know, 1 and 10 straight bets per game. So you got 16 games going on the first day, 16 games the second day, and then 8 each on the Saturday and Sunday.
And how accurate have you been?
Oh, you know, to really make money in Las Vegas on sports betting, you really only have to get it about a 60-65% clip. I'd say in a good year, I've been up around 80, and some years I've been down around 40.
So you're an engineer. Do you actually just crunch numbers to get the probabilities and the odds, or do you kind of get emotional about some teams?
Well, emotions certainly play into it sometimes. Generally speaking, you want to try to avoid teams that you have an emotional interest in. You know, I wouldn't say that I crunch the numbers specifically, but there's kind of a gut evaluation that takes place between the overall odds, say a money line wager, versus a point spread for a particular game. You get to understand what those numbers should look like on paper, and when there's a little bit of an askew line on the board, because you know Vegas is just taking a 10% cut of all the winning bets. So sometimes you'll actually be able to take advantage of a line that's a little bit off.
Okay, so let's go to Dan Shanoff, freelance sports writer. Dan, very often people do go with their gut in terms of turning out their brackets and turning them in. So can you give us kind of some educated advice on how to fill these brackets out and balance the numbers with our gut feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I would be a cautionary tale for the gut. Last year, I went with my gut and finished in the 20th percentile in my bracket in my pool.
Oh,
but I have learned from the experience, and so here's at least one big piece of advice. Pay attention to the crowd. Right? There's all these aggregators out there that will kind of crunch it, to the extent they will crunch the numbers of what everyone is picking, right? And so you get a nice wisdom of the crowd factor going and what the crowd is saying is that Kansas is going to win the tournament, and they're the top-seeded team going into the tournament, and that they're going to beat Kentucky in the championship game, and Kentucky is the second-best team in the tournament. And at some point, the combination of the selection committee's seeding of the entire bracket and what everyone around you is thinking and saying should factor into kind of, you know, what will probably happen. And if last year is any indication, where North Carolina, the best team in the country and the top-seeded team heading into the tournament, rolled its way to the championship, it's a pretty good indicator if your goal is to get the champion right.
But Dan, there's always got to be a Gonzaga out there, right? There's always a Cinderella team.
That's my team. Hey, come on. Gonzaga's mine.
See, this is what I'm saying.
Absolutely, and so you definitely want to sprinkle your bracket with a couple of upsets. And traditionally, the classic upset is the fifth seeded team losing to the 12th seeded team. And this year, there's actually of the four matchups, there are three that I think most fans are eyeing and thinking could have some upset potential. One is Texas El Paso over Butler, Cornell over Temple, and Utah State over Texas A&M. For whatever reason, the 12th seeded team ends up being a little bit stronger than their seed would suggest.
Mike, are you looking at those games?
Well, yeah, sure. You got to be a little bit careful. You know, in Vegas, we're doing a lot of straight wagering on the individual contests. But when you're filling out your bracket, you know, you'll be in some pools where the seed multiplier per round makes a business case for choosing those.
But Mike, what's it come down to? Who are your final four?
Well, Duke's got an easy road, so I'm in there. I like Kansas coming out of their bracket, and I've got some surprises for the 2 seed and the 3 seed coming out of the other bracket.
He's being cagey. Dan, who are your picks?
Kansas, Kentucky, Syracuse, And my one non-final four team is Villanova over Duke.
A brilliant, brilliant man. Those happen to be my final four picks. Dan Shanoff, freelance sports writer and contributor to SportingNews.com and The Wall Street Journal. We also talked to Mike Hyland, an engineer who's headed off to Las Vegas. Thanks to both of you. You can get some more tips on brackets. We are posting the brackets of Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen and my brackets. They're online at thetakeaway.org. Coming up... Did they just say sure and bagora, you want it and more?
Mm.
We're going to be talking about food as we do on Wednesdays. And today, the iconic shamrock shake.
Iconic. Tastes like Pepto-Bismol.
The taste has nothing to do with whether it's... There's a lot of icons that are not entirely 100% positive and beloved. But people love the Shamrock Shake, John. They love it.
Oh, God bless them. Now to the serious situation with the Pope Benedict. Up until a few days ago, it was the case that people believed that the Pope has been very forthcoming and actually aggressively dealing with the sex scandals that have plagued the Catholic Church for decades. But all that has changed. The Pope himself is now actually accused of possibly protecting or at the very least overlooking sex abuse charges against a priest in Munich back when the Pope was Archbishop Ratzinger of Munich. To talk more about that, we spoke earlier this morning with David Willey, BBC correspondent in Rome, and he told us that it's not an exaggeration to say that the Vatican is in crisis mode.
I think they realize it's a very serious crisis, but of course the Vatican is making encouraging noises all the time, saying that this is only a very tiny minority involved in sexual abuse, and that most priests are upright and God-fearing people who carry out the work of the Church faithfully throughout their whole lifetime. The problem is that in Germany the press has been digging into the record of what Cardinal Ratzinger, as he then was doing when he was Archbishop of Munich, and he obviously has people there who are taking the rap for him at the moment. The Pope is not personally involved in any wrongdoing, as far as we can gather. However, it happened on his watch, and as local Archbishop, he was ultimately responsible for dealing with these cases in his own diocese, and it's extraordinary that the priest concerned has only actually been suspended this week.
Well, that's the interesting point, because the fact that this particular priest, his name was Father Peter Hullermann, we understand, Hullermann, he was still working in the church as recently as yesterday until he was suspended, which leads me to believe that the hierarchy within the Catholic Church is orchestrating this.
Well, the innuendo is that not only in Germany, but in America and in Ireland and in all the countries where sexual abuse has been reported, the Church has been applying double standards. I think the problem is that there is a church law, ecclesiastical law, called canon law, and there is the law of the confession. So when ecclesiastical authorities find out about these cases of sexual abuse of minors by priests, instead of informing the police, they tend to think, first of all, about protecting the good name of the Church. And this, I think, has led to this disastrous policy in recent years, the fruits of which we're now seeing in Rome this week.
I'm wondering if one of the consequences, and the Pope, we understand, is under some pressure to actually speak out on this scandal. We don't know if he will. But does this accelerate the power shift in the Catholic Church away from European congregations and constituencies and more towards Latin America and Africa?
Well, this is, of course, a trend. It's very interesting. In this year's Vatican Yearbook, for the first time, they give the numbers of the priests worldwide. And the priests in Latin America and Africa now are slightly outnumbered those in the developed world, in Europe and in North America. So clearly there is a shift going on here, a very important, the tectonic plates, as it were, are moving. And I think this is all part of the story. But But, of course, insofar as the sexual abuse scandal is concerned, it is a very serious matter.
Right.
The Pope has already been preparing during these days.
It's David Willey, BBC correspondent in Rome, one of the most experienced Vatican reporters, talking about the sex scandal possibly entangling Pope Benedict himself.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there, John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Now, think green food, okay? Think salad, think guacamole, okay? Think pea soup.
Cabbage.
Now, forget all that.
Welcome back. Hello, spring. Come on, let's celebrate with McDonald's, thick, rich, also creamy, great green shamrock shake.
That's right. It's the Shamrock Shake Day for St. Paddy's Day. Our food segment is all about what's in that shamrock shake. We'll check in on that in a few moments, right after Leading Stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Police in Afghanistan say they've killed two militants who attacked government buildings in the south of the country. Police said the men were dressed in burqas. Meanwhile, in neighboring Pakistan, security officials have said two separate missile strikes by American drones have killed at least eight suspected militants. The attacks were in a known stronghold of Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants in the northwest of the country. The U.S. and Israel are trying to heal their worst rift in years. New settler homes in East Jerusalem and the reopening of a synagogue yesterday brought demonstrators out onto the streets. Here's Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saab Erekat.
The confliction and the escalation are what's needed from the international community now, and this can be attended to only by having the Prime Minister of Israel stop such provocative and such fait accompli policies.
Back at home, supporters and opponents in the healthcare battle are making final pushes to sway this week's vote. President Obama is making calls and having private chats to rally Democrats. Meanwhile, advocacy groups are running ad campaigns in districts where Democratic lawmakers are thought to be on the fence. The currency fight between the U.S. and China is heating up. Earlier this week, Chinese leaders said they opposed any country that'll force China to change the value of its currency. But yesterday, the U.S. Senate proposed a bill that could force the currency value to rise. We spoke earlier to the BBC's Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg and asked him to explain what's going on.
Well, on the one hand, you've got U.S. politicians appealing to the White House, saying it's very important that in mid-April, President Obama labels China a currency manipulator and saying that unless this produces some kind of change from the Chinese, then some kind of tariffs should be slapped on Chinese goods to help make them more expensive, if you like, and make it easier for American goods to compete. Some people, they will regard this as a nuclear option, if you like, because it would lead to, if it was passed, it would lead to, or if the White House acted on it, it could lead to the opening skirmishes in a trade war.
And how has the international banking community weighed in on this?
Well, it's interesting. We've heard from Dominique Strauss-Kahn. He's the managing director of the IMF. He's been speaking in Europe today. He has come in and said the yuan is very much undervalued, and it is in the logic of rebalancing the economy, the world economy, to allow it to appreciate. So he's coming in on the same side as those American lawmakers. But from China, they've just hit back. The Commerce Ministry saying focusing on the yuan would not solve trade problems. And they came up with this one suggestion. They say the U.S. could lift exports by lifting its ban on exports of high-tech products. So no suggestion from China that they're going to cave in on this one.
And no glimmer of hope that there's going to be any kind of reconciliation point.
I think it's going to be almost impossible because they would lose so much face if they did this now. And in this country, as you know, losing face is something, especially in the government, that you don't want to offer your opponents.
That was Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg with our partner, the BBC. And that's some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Okay, so it's Foodie Wednesday here on The Takeaway. It's also St. Patrick's Day, and no one today is going to accuse us of cuisine snobbery, that's for sure. Because there are certain food rituals associated with St. Patrick's Day that are deeply beloved. And let's get the categories straight, first of all. I mean, there's going to be lots of people who get out the green food coloring to tweak the cupcakes, to tint the cookies, to lime the jello, to make verdant all that rice, and maybe turn their Guinness green. But there is one sweet celebratory concoction that possibly wins the crowd pleaser award on this day, and that's the McDonald's Shamrock
shake. And Kyra Kiles, you're a fan, right?
Yes, I am a huge fan.
A huge fan. And Kevin Sturtz, you are also a fan of the Shamrock Shake?
That is correct.
All right. Kevin Sturtz is the publisher of TheAmazingServiceGuy.com, a business and customer loyalty specialist, and he's written about the Shamrock Shake's success as a product. And Kyra Kiles is a writer for the Tribune Red Eye in Chicago. And, you know, some people have described you as the biggest Shamrock Shake fan in the world. That doesn't refer to your girth or anything, does it?
Not at all, but good. I have also been referred to as borderline obsessive, but I wear the badge proudly. I love those shakes.
Now, first, let's talk about the mystery of the shakes. They are available at McDonald's, and presumably, Kevin, they're a successful product, but all McDonald's don't have them. First of all, Kevin, why is that?
You know, I believe the reason all McDonald's don't have them is because it's a seasonal product. Sort of the, one of the strengths is also a weakness in the eyes of, say, the typical owner of a McDonald's. They feel like, oh, it's only here for a month. We've got to buy extra supplies. We've got to train people on it. Maybe it's just not worth it for that small period of time.
All right, so they're slightly hard to find, and you got to find that McDonald's franchise owner that's really into this sort of thing. Kyra, what do you believe is in a Shamrock Shake?
Well, you know, I've actually been trying to figure it out because, sadly, this year I found that in the Chicago market, at least, they're not as minty as they used to be. So I have been trying to figure out what is the exact mint formulation that's in there. And it's also been less green this year. It might also be because they're serving it in a clear cup now, so you can really get a good look at the shake. And it looks kind of pale. So Shamrock Shake Finders and I have been trying to figure out some alternatives because we haven't been loving the shake that we have here in Chicago as much.
Now, Kyra, you know, from my standpoint, okay, it seems to me that the Shamrock Shake is a huge risk for McDonald's, and I want to get Kevin's opinion on this, because, you know, a minty, thick drink, I'm thinking Pepto-Bismol. I'm not thinking dessert. And that anytime you do something minty like that, you're going to remind people of something that you would not want people drinking milkshakes to be reminded of.
Rango Mint melted, and that might be something that's really familiar to the Chicago area. At Macy's, Marshall Fields, we used to have Rango Mints, and everyone likes them. And that might also be why they're not available throughout the country, is because it is this taste that maybe just some markets really like. But I love it. I think it tastes like I said, more of a Rango Mint melted down than anything else.
And Rango Mints, boy, that's a blast from the past, talking about Chicago Rango Mints. Kevin Sturtz, what do you attribute the success why is the product successful?
You know, John, I think it's successful because they did a couple of things very well. They, for one thing, it's green, like you point out, but it's a fun green. It's a friendly green.
We don't have
a lot of green food, as you know, especially, and they market it to kids. So by tying it to a holiday that's kind of a fun holiday, it's the springtime, it's the time of rebirth and renewal, and they tied it to leprechauns. So how can you go wrong with a fun little leprechaun character carrying around your green minty shamrock shake? So
look, you're the expert, Kevin, but seaweed green, that's not a fun green? Salad green, not a fun green?
You know, I think if you're a kid, the minty, cool, creamy Shamrock Shake, I think it beats it. Plus, think of how fun it is to say it, John. I can't even say it this morning. But with the alliteration, Shamrock Shake. See, there's nothing that's not fun about a Shamrock Shake.
I'll tell you what's not fun about a Shamrock Shake, trying to find a McDonald's that serves them.
Yeah, well, you had some trouble here in New Jersey.
I did. I was trying to bring them in last night so we'd have them this morning during this discussion of Shamrock Shakes. I drove for a while and couldn't get a McDonald's that had them.
Well, we often end these segments with recipes. Kyra, it sounds like you're concerned about the paleness this year and the lack of mintiness. Have you tried to make a Shamrock Shake on your own?
You know what? I'm going to try to do that on my blog and do like a video demonstration. Someone told me that if you take a fourth or a half teaspoon of mint extract, you can add 5 drops of green food coloring and you will get an approximation and use the vanilla shake that McDonald's sells. So I'm going to try that. And then I also had one of my fellow bloggers develop a vegan version for people who don't drink dairy. And I tried that, and we're going to unveil that tomorrow on my site at redeyechicago.com/Kyles file.
The unveiling is tomorrow. Good luck to both of you. Kyra Kiles is a writer for the Tribune Red Eye blog in Chicago, and Kevin Sturtz is the publisher of AmazingServiceGuy.com, the Shamrock
Shake. And happy St. Paddy's, everybody.
If you can't find a Shamrock Shake near you, like me, they're extremely simple to make at home. You can check out our recipe at thetakeaway.org. In fact, there's lots of bonuses for you on our website, so I encourage you to go. This isn't just a time for Shamrock Shakes. It is March Madness time. We talked about brackets earlier, gave you some tips on how to fill yours out. And on the website, you can see the brackets filled out by our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. You can also see my picks as well at thetakeaway.org. We've also been getting your personal reactions to the census and some of the surprising categories that are on the census form and aren't. We did have one listener tell us, I always answer the race question, I check the other box and then write in human. Accurate, truthful, and legal. We've got more of your census stories at thetakeaway.org.
Yes, in America, human is a write-in vote. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. Good morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. It is Wednesday, March 17th. John, let's say before you got married, were you completely open? Did you talk about all money?
I'm not talking about this.
You refuse to talk about money with me.
In fact, I'm going to change the subject and talk about the news. In fact, right now,
typical.
Let's check in on the top stories in the news. The big question on Capitol Hill this week, will House Democrats have enough votes to pass health care reform? House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer tells ABC News this morning.
We think we'll have the votes when the roll is called.
At this time, Democrats appear to be somewhat short of the 216 votes they need. A vote is expected Friday or Saturday. Meanwhile, some religious leaders are telling undocumented immigrants in the United States not to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera is the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches.
How in the world are we going to ask undocumented immigrants to trust and to open the door where they have no assurances that that information will be confidential? I will not be used against them.
Other religious leaders and census officials say confidentiality is not a problem and that a boycott is actually counterproductive.
The Homeland Security Department is cutting millions of dollars intended for a high-tech virtual fence along the Mexican border. Secretary Napolitano says about $50 million in stimulus money will go toward radios and cameras instead. And we're looking this morning at the racial gap in terms of wealth in this country, specifically how minority women are doing financially compared to their white counterparts. We're joined now by Esther Bush. She's president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh, and she works on educating the urban poor about how to save their money. Good morning, Esther.
Good morning.
Those numbers I cited at the top of the show are from a new study that I know you've looked at, and I'm wondering if you were surprised by this wide gap, how wide this gap is between black and Hispanic women and their white counterparts.
Yes, I knew the gap was wide, but it is even worse than I had predicted. There are things that we really need to address in this country to close that gap.
And we're going to be asking you more about what those things are that we need to do. Esther Bush, stay with us.
In Israel, tensions remain high this morning after violence on the streets of Jerusalem yesterday. Meanwhile, the White House has reiterated its strong bonds with the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, attempting to heal a historic rift between the U.S. and Israel. The Prime Minister of Israel will visit Washington next week. In Pakistan this morning, five Americans were charged with planning terrorist attacks against that country. The men, all Muslims from the Washington, D.C. area, have pleaded not guilty to the charges. They face life in prison if convicted.
And happy St. Patrick's Day to our Irish listeners. That's the sound of Irish step dancers in Dublin's St. Patrick's Day parade, courtesy of CBS News. Ireland's President, Mary McAleese, paid tribute today to the 70 million people of Irish descent celebrating around the world. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will get underway this hour at 10,685, the S&P at 1,159, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. So we start this new series this week, which obviously John will not be participating in since he can't talk about money.
I'm just so guilty.
We're going to be talking about how to do it yourself, a do-it-yourself financial bailout. And we're wondering, what is it? What's a financially taboo topic? Clearly for John, everything. But what will you not talk about? Personal finances
my wallet
too personal?
Is empty.
And all right, let's go a little step further. Are you willing to tell us how much you make? How much money do you make? What's your salary?
No, I can't do
it. Is that taboo?
Can't do it.
Oh, John, give us your stories since John won't. At 877-8-MY-TAKE, we're going to be talking more about that later this hour.
Serious discussion of the racial gender gap in poverty.
Income does not equal wealth. That's because between the amount of your paycheck and how much you actually put in the bank, there's all those other things like your debt and your expenses that you have to pay. You may not be able to keep much of your income. But wealth means financial security. So what we now know is that there's actually a racial gap when it comes to employment. But even for those who are employed, for those who have a good income, there's still a racial gap in terms of wealth. And it's especially bad for women of color. Here are some of the numbers, not including the cars they own. Let's set cars aside. The average single white woman has about $4,000 in assets. The average Hispanic woman has $120. And the average African-American woman, only about $100. We've got Ella Edmondson Bell with us to talk about this. She's a professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School, and she joins us from North Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you explain to me why this is? Why is there such a vast gap between the races on the issue of wealth?
Well, I think one reason is that there is such a thing as generational wealth. Wealth that is passed down from our parents, our grandparents, African-American women, Hispanic women. We come from families where there is not, where we don't get a leg up from generational wealth because our parents and our grandparents didn't have that wealth to pass down to us. So we start at the short end of the stick. The next problem is that we are in industries and in jobs that do not give us the good fringe benefits. We don't get the big bonuses. We don't get good pension plans. We don't get health plans. So those monies have to be put out in other ways. So not only do we not bring it in terms of salary, we're not getting the fringe benefits that often come with salary that allows us to put more money away.
Ella, there's also another issue that I was interested to read about, and that's that sometimes the expenses themselves are higher. For example, there's a lot of instances of redlining in urban communities on the parts of insurance companies. So they're paying higher insurance rate for their homes and their cars. Their expenses are higher.
And if you look at the latest mortgage fiasco, many African-American women were caught up on that in terms of the types of mortgages that they were able to get, and that those mortgages were the high prime mortgages, subprime mortgages, and fell through the cracks and required much more money with less house. And then there's the other reality that many of the women we're talking about are either single, divorced, and single heads of households. So there's not a double income there to consider. So there's even less money to put away. A woman is responsible for not only providing food, clothing, and shelter, but daycare and everything else for her family on a very low income rate.
Okay, so there's a lot of contributing factors here.
This should not come as a big, big surprise, to be honest with you.
Okay, let's go back to Esther Bush, who heads the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. Esther, you take all these contributing factors and you say, well, listen, there's still things that you can do about that, right? For this public that you serve, the community that you serve, you're trying to help them out through financial literacy, trying to help them get better mortgages, get better loans, right?
Absolutely. And the information that was just shared, we see it every single day. And it's important for your entire listening audience to understand the impact of all of those things over decades and generations. Right now, we have a mortgage foreclosure program with women coming in, and it is some of the deals that the mortgage owners are trying to have these women sign are unbelievable. I even took a couple of them to my board meeting, and the head of my board, who is an attorney, he read the paper and literally opened his mouth. He could not believe that a firm, a bank, a mortgage company was asking somebody to sign papers that if my mortgage is $300 today and I can't pay it, how am I going to pay you $450 over the next X amount of months to catch up? So even some of the remedies are just really, truly ridiculous. And the way things are designed, they're designed seemingly to keep these women and other poor, low-income people in the hole.
Okay, well, explain to me, what are the number one and number two things that someone can do who's in this situation? Maybe somebody has a good income and they want to start building their assets and building their wealth. What are the first things they should do?
The first thing they should do is put the themselves on a budget, and no matter the amount of their income, make sure that they put aside something to save. People always say, or typically say, you know, I don't make enough to save. Yes, you do. If it's $5 a paycheck, if it's $10, until you can get up to $100 or whatever is affordable for you, because what's critically important is to begin the habit, is to begin to understand the critical importance of savings and understanding how that savings can swell over time.
Okay, Ella, explain to me, is there a cultural gap here as well? We're talking about minority communities in which Esther is talking about a financial literacy problem where she's trying to help them get loans that are to their advantage and help them get fair insurance rates. Is there a cultural gap?
I think there is an exposure issue. If my mother and father had to work doubly hard just to keep a roof over my head, make sure I was fed, we didn't talk about necessarily savings. We didn't talk about stock. We didn't talk about investment. I think that is an issue that plagues our community. We are in a position where we don't have a lot of extra income at all. So ways that we can build wealth, particularly ways that whites have the opportunity to do because they've been exposed early on. I mean, many of my students, for example, at the Tuck School of Business have had stock since they were children. That was an event, a game that they had with their parents. Each birthday, they got shares in stock and would follow it. You don't have that in our communities because we just don't have the knowledge, but we also don't have the monies to put aside like that, quite honestly. So the ways that whites in their culture, many of them who can build wealth, we just don't have access to that.
That's Ella Edmondson-Bell, professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and Esther Bush is the president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh. Thanks to both of you. And now let's check in on the top stories at 15 minutes after the hour.
We begin with Capitol Hill health care reform. Another day of arm twisting as President Obama sits down with wavering or reluctant House Democrats today. Opponents of the president's plans continue to run ad campaigns to kill the current bill. Meanwhile, a bill to encourage businesses to hire unemployed workers is expected to clear Congress today. It faces a vote in the Senate. The measure would give companies a temporary payroll tax holiday. Some economic news in the past hour. Prices at the wholesale level are showing their biggest drop in 7 months. They fell in February by 0.6%. And some experts are calling a robbery in Connecticut, quote, one of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history. Thieves, bold thieves, made off with $75 million worth of prescription drugs. We're going to have more on that heist very, very shortly.
Religious leaders disagree on whether undocumented immigrants in their congregation should complete census forms. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez says any kind of boycott of the census would be foolish.
If we boycott the census, we're boycotting representation, number one. Number two, we are boycotting funds and resources for better schools, more police officers, community development.
And finally, it is St. Patrick's Day.
When
The Irish tenor. Ireland is hoping to get a tourist bump out of today's celebrations. The country's main tourism agency has managed to get a number of major world landmarks to go green. One example, the Sydney Opera House today, bathed in green light. And at the White House, President Obama meets with the Irish Prime Minister, Brian Cohen. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, Tiger returning to golf.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout sounds like a TV movie. It's that unbelievable. Christine Dempsey joins us now, staff reporter for the Hartford Courant, where in Enfield, Connecticut, nearby you, Christine, some thieves got away with $75 million worth of pharmaceutical drugs. What are the details? And good morning to you.
Good morning. This was a real Mission Impossible-style theft. This is something that the town of Enfield, Connecticut, has never, ever seen before. What happened was there were some thieves, more than one definitely, who planned this well-thought-out heist. They scaled the outside walls of a warehouse in Enfield. They cut a hole in the roof, and they slid down ropes to get inside. They quickly disarmed the alarm, and over the course of a few hours, they stole several dozens of pallets of prescription drug medication.
And these are huge skids that have boxes of drugs that are labeled sitting around the warehouse, right? And this is an Eli Lilly warehouse.
Yes, that was Eli Lilly, and they have a warehouse there. It is the East Coast distribution facility.
And I gather the people at the Eli Lilly company, or at least this warehouse, are probably going through personnel records this morning. I mean, this sounds like an inside job of some sort.
I had the same thought. I asked Police Chief Carl Safraza this morning that question. I asked him yesterday also, and he said they don't want to just go with one theory at this point. He wants his detectives to be open-minded about how they handle this and how they do this investigation. So they are considering all possibilities at this point.
Christine Dempsey, any sense of the black market for these drugs? You've got Prozac, you've got Cymbalta, Zyprexa. These are some of Eli Lilly's best-selling drugs. Last year. No painkillers or narcotics taken. These are antidepressants.
Correct, exactly. But as you know, certainly prescription drugs are very, very expensive. And there is a black market, so to speak. Online, people can buy drugs online, unfortunately, that may be obtained illegally. In other countries, too, like South America or Asia, where drug regulations are lax, it's more common that these would be sold. These aren't the types of drugs that are going to surface at the local CVS, though.
But it's interesting what you're saying. These are not necessarily drug abusers who are the market for these drugs. These are people possibly diagnosed with bipolar disorder and actual maladies who are trying to get discounts over the retail price of prescriptions.
Good point. I mean, maybe unknowingly, certainly, people may be trying to get a good bargain on the internet and they may end up buying illegal drugs, but that's true.
Well, lots of the details remain to be discovered here. Christine Dempsey covering the story of the heist in Enfield, Connecticut, where thieves scaled the walls of an Eli Lilly warehouse and made off with $75 million worth of pills. Just could be a snapshot of the healthcare industry unwittingly there by those thieves. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
If there's one thing that could out-headline NCAA March Madness, it would be Tiger Woods. And Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here is to talk about Tiger's return to golf at the upcoming Masters in Augusta, Georgia. The big question, whether or not he's going to be able to perform as well as he did in the past before all the scandals. Ibrahim, will he be able to retain his focus in light of everything that's happened to him?
Well, this is the first time he's going to be playing on a golf course in competition since November 15th when he won the Australian Masters in Melbourne. That was his 82nd career victory. So now he's returning after all the scandal, after all the treatment. And I think this is the ideal place for him to return because Augusta really controls the environment for the Masters. So if you heckle, if you're out of line, you get kicked out. It's not like the U.S. Open where it's just kind of like this massive stuff.
Still, I mean, it's like being under a microscope and in a stadium at the same time.
And I think he knows this course well. He's played here. He's played extremely well here. So I think this is the ideal setting for Tiger to return. And like I said before, when this first came out, I have a feeling Tiger's going to play extremely well. He doesn't really know how to be a father or a husband. Those are all new things to him. But out of all the things that he knows how to do, he knows how to play golf. And now that he'll get back into a competition arena, I think he's going to play extremely well.
You don't think that this has shaken him? And I mean, golf, John was saying this morning, golf is really about focus, about quieting your mind and just focusing.
I think this is part of he's still in treatment. So he says that he's still in treatment. He's still going through this making the changes in his personal life. This is actually, to me, part of his treatment. If he can sort of hone in and focus, I think for him, golf is a meditative space and a meditative state. And he'll have the chatter from being a cheat and a liar in his personal life away. So this will kind of, the seas are kind of parted personally for him. So I think he's going to actually be able to focus even more because it's kind of like what happened with A-Rod where he was using steroids and he wasn't playing as well. Well, now all that stuff quieted away, and he was able to really focus on the game.
And Tiger Woods is a practicing Buddhist. I mean, you got to figure maybe he's going to bring a busload of Buddhist priests along to sort of stay behind him, to kind of crowd around him, to keep him quiet.
No, wait, the Dalai Lama didn't even know who Tiger Woods was. That's
very Buddhist. You have to admit, that's very Buddhist.
It is very Buddhist. But, you know, here's the thing. Tiger is going to be under more the pressure is higher now than ever before because if he fails, it's so predictable. His entire life, you know, crashes and burns. He just, you know, he was once great and now will wash up. And yet, if he succeeds, everyone says, well, he's put that all behind him and he can get back to, I mean, the pressure, the stakes could not be higher.
The most important thing for him to do is make the cut. And I think for the television ratings, this is going to be critical. This is going to be a huge, one of the most watched golf matches, tournaments in history because of Tiger's return. So I think,
unless he's out in the first round.
Exactly. So I think the focus is for Tiger. If Tiger does well early on and he makes the cut and he gets into the, starts to do well early, then we'll see. Then we can start talking about Tiger winning, and that'll create this huge storm of energy and interest. So I think for him, he's just focusing on what's in front of him.
It's almost the only way he's going to be able to put this behind.
Without a doubt.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor, thanks so much. Coming up, the healthcare battle may be ending soon, but how did we get here? What's the beginning, middle, and the end of the healthcare reform story? Also, later this hour, we're going to start a new series called DIY Bailout, you helping yourself with your own bailout. And we're asking you, are there money topics that are taboo? Do you not like to talk about money? Will you not talk about money? And how much do you make? Is that a taboo question? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE. More about this later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, seeking the narrative in the healthcare reform debate. When there's not even an ending yet, a filmmaker struggles to find the story in healthcare reform. That's in just a few moments, but let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. More about that healthcare battle. We're learning this morning, even if Democrats don't get the votes in the House, they might try another way to pass the bill. It's an arcane procedure where the Senate bill would be deemed to have passed if House members voted in favor of a separate bill with health care provisions attached. Republicans say Democrats shouldn't use the tactic with a bill of this magnitude, but House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer had this to say on ABC News this morning.
Unfortunately, the Republicans are a little bit like the boy who killed his two parents and then wants sympathy because they're an orphan.
A House vote is expected Friday or Saturday. We'll have more on this story in just a moment.
The Pentagon is trying to curb the abuse of painkillers by soldiers. Military doctors wrote almost 4 million prescriptions for painkillers last year. That's more than four times the doses handed out in 2001. But officials say the increase reflects the continuing toll of fighting two major wars. And Facebook has edged out Google as the most visited website in the U.S. Facebook previously had reached the number one rank on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, a few other days, but it had never kept the top spot for a full week until now. Facebook accounted for over 7% of all internet visits in the U.S. last week. New economic numbers out this morning show wholesale prices are showing their largest drop in 7 months. They fell in February by 0.6% as the decrease in energy prices offset higher food costs. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow is up 30, the S&P is up 3, and the NASDAQ is up about 5. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Good morning, everyone. We're joined now by Michael Kirk, who's a frontline producer. And on April 13th, his film Obama's Deal will air. Frontline, of course, is a production of our partner WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Michael Kirk.
Good morning, John.
Who joins us from the Boston area. And you don't have an ending to this film, do you yet?
Not yet, and I'm crossing my fingers one way or the other. The film will end, but it's whether it's a happy ending for the president or a less happy ending.
And the happy ending also would refer either, depending on how you believe politically, for all American citizens who have something at stake in this debate. Michael Kirk, it seems to me, and we've got some excerpts from your film. Here's Dan Pfeiffer, a White House communications director, and this comes directly from your film, which is currently in the edit room right now, that the stakes of this entire battle here are pretty neatly laid out in this remark right here.
We were sitting in the Oval Office as we were sort of having a debate around health care at one point. The president said, it's about health care, but it's not really about health care. It's also about proving whether we can still solve big problems in this country. And this was going to be the test case for that.
Now, Michael Kirk, when did that meeting take place that Dan Pfeiffer is referring to? And did the president really launch this entire narrative by saying, can we solve big problems in the United States anymore?
Well, he launched it, I think, way back when he was running for the presidency and said and promised to try to change the culture and the way of operating in Washington. Healthcare, I think, was his test case, the case study that he would use to try to change the narrative of the way the pernicious politics of our country have been run for a number of presidencies. This particular meeting happened very early in the presidency when Joe Biden and others sat around and said, absolutely not. Don't take on universal health care. I've seen it eat too many presidencies alive.
Wow.
At the same time that Geithner and Summers were sitting in there saying, we've got an economy that's crashing. You got to pay attention to job one. But President Obama wanted an issue that he thought could demonstrate how different his presidency would be, and health care became that issue.
And he began to acquire the allies who would help to shape that message and to shape the entire narrative going forward. What's the first milestone, as you see it in this story, really, and it begins right after the election?
It's a very interesting case of an outsider suddenly surrounding himself, because I think he probably realized he had to, and the advice he was receiving was he had to. He had surrounded himself with insiders, former people who had worked in Congress all around the West Wing, including Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff. But the primary person he brought in was one of the great Washington quintessential insiders, Tom Daschle, who'd been the majority leader for the Democrats and had been unelected by the people in his home state, and was at the time a health care lobbyist, or not a lobbyist legally, but a person who advocated for health care groups in Washington and very well known to the president.
And, you know, as you say, former majority leader in the Senate and a powerful person in Washington, and some have called him the most knowledgeable person on health care. But almost immediately that choice went south. Here's Jon Stewart on The Daily Show on February 2nd, 2009.
I do want to say a quick word to anyone out there who wants to bring change and hope to a deeply divided and suffering America. Pay your f***ing taxes. We're not asking you to be perfect. You want to be in the cabinet? We're not saying you can't throw a little under the table to the Guatemalan nanny. You're not saying you can't accept a couple of thanks for your help fruit baskets from the boys down at Local 238. But Tom Daschle? Obama's pick for health secretary?
Here, Michael Kirk, frontline producer, you see the cynicism that now suffuses this entire debate on health care reform starting to sweep in.
It begins literally, it's a great clip because it begins literally right at that moment. He's less than a month in, and he loses his primary point person on the issue because of the not only taxes, but he gets Daschle gets eaten alive by a rival in the Senate, Max Baucus, and Baucus's kind of partner on the Senate Finance Committee, the Republican Senator Charles Grassley.
And if the original turning point in this debate was the acquisition of Rahm Emanuel as sort of chief of staff for the president, someone with a aggressive reputation for working on Capitol Hill, the demise of Tom Daschle being another turning point. Things really, really turned in the summer of 2009. Describe what you think is the critical turning point in the summer of 2009.
One of the things that Obama needed if he was going to get the bill passed was speed. It had to happen while the new president still had some juice. What happened with the Republicans was they intentionally slowed it down so that across the summer it was like heavy boots walking in mud over at Congress to try to get anything done. What they were essentially doing...
Here's the sound of some of those boots. This comes directly from your film. Do you think the president walked into this?
I think he did, sort of unknowingly. They hadn't really anticipated the anger and the fervor and the ability of Republicans and others, including indigenous movements like the Tea Party movement, to stoke it up and make it happen when Congress went home in August. And that really took it right to the precipice, that is the health care bill.
Well, your film will air April 13th, where we will know the outcome here. Where do you think we are right now before we go, Michael Kirk?
I think we're right on the edge, John. I think the president is counting votes. If he had them, there'd be a vote on it. We'd be hearing about it right now. He still doesn't have them even a year into this process.
If you had a camera anywhere in Washington right now, where would you want it?
I'd be right over Rahm Emanuel's shoulder.
Ooh, good call. There may be some of those POV shots in the Frontline special, Obama's Deal, produced by my guest Michael Kirk, producer for the forthcoming documentary. It'll be broadcast by Frontline and our partner station, WGBH, on April 13th. Thanks to Michael Kirk for joining us. We start a new series this week, DIY Bailout. How can you help yourself out of financial straits since you don't have the TARP to help you in Washington? We start off talking about why finances is a taboo subject between family and friends. What about your personal finances? Do you find it hardest to share with other people? And let's try this honestly. Are you willing to tell us what you make? How much?
This is Kelly from South Carolina. I went from making close to $30,000 in 2008 with two jobs to making $14,000 in 2009 due to maternity leave and loss of my main job. So that was kind of a hit.
Ooh, thanks for sharing, but ouch. Share your salary and your taboo financial subjects at 877-8-MY-TAKE. More on that later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. One way that we know that the Detroit public schools are in crisis is that they have an emergency financial manager. His name is Robert Bob. Another way that we know that is that Robert Bob has announced the city will close 45 more schools this year. This is part of his plan, Robert Bob's plan, to fix the city's failing school system. And to talk more about it, we have Noah Ovshinsky from Detroit. He's an education reporter for our member station, WDET. And Noah, you've been covering the Detroit City Schools pretty much for as long as you've been reporting in Detroit. So tell me about this plan to close 45 schools. Is that a positive thing, or is this kind of an indication that the school system is dying?
Well, Celeste, it depends on what side you fall on. If you're a student or a parent, in the short term, it means a lot of disruption. It means that if you're a student that's been a DPS for at least 5 or 6 years, chances are you've moved schools at least once. So there is a lot of disruption that comes with this plan. If you're the district, it means you're saving a lot of money. This $31 million alone, if they close the full 45 buildings this year. So it all depends on what side of the line you fall on.
I would imagine that some of this is just related to the fact that the population of the city of Detroit has shrunk, that this is a city that was built to accommodate millions of people and now has maybe 800 or 900,000 people in it.
Yeah, to give you a flavor of the situation, Celeste, the district has 84,000 students this year. It's lost about 10,000 students a year for the last decade, and they're expecting enrollment to drop to as low as 56,000 by 2014. So there is a need to shrink the physical size of the district only because there are so many empty seats. That's due to declining enrollment. That's due to parents losing their job and moving out of the city, or students going to other districts outside of DPS. They live in the city, but they go to charters and private schools and parochial schools.
Well, here is Robert Bob telling reporters about this plan to shrink the school system.
We must reduce and eliminate our deficit. We must cut non-critical spending to create a smaller, more agile system with increased flexibility, credibility, and accountability.
Okay, and part of this more agile system means that people are going to be losing their jobs.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how many and what kind of jobs are going to be lost. We know that when you eliminate 45 buildings, many of those schools, you're going to lose teachers, you're going to lose principals and assistant principals and engineers. So yeah, there's going to be a lot fewer people working in the district if this plan goes through. That said, the academic nature of the district is going to change drastically. Most of the schools now will be pre-K through 8, which is an increasing movement throughout the country. And also, they're going to create larger campuses from pre-K through full colleges. They're going to bring colleges in on some of these big campuses to teach classes to some of their students.
How much is the Detroit public school system in the red right now, Noah?
Well, it depends on the day, Celeste, but today I believe it's about $316 million in the red.
That's a lot of change, and hopefully closing schools will bring them closer, but we don't know by how much?
This year alone, we're looking at a savings of $31 million with the closings. And, of course, over time, they're looking at several more millions being saved.
If I do my math right, that's still over $250 million of red ink. Noah Ovshinsky is an education reporter for WDET, our member station in Detroit. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry on this St. Patrick's Day. And we're starting a new series this week. It's called DIY Bailout, How You Can Help Yourself Out of Financial Trouble. And the
step
first
one is like admitting you have a problem.
Well, you know, there's the 12 steps, right, for alcohol
don't
problems.
Remind me.
With money, there's also some steps. And the first one is the same as for 12 steps. It's admit you have a problem, which means you have to talk about it, which is a problem for a lot of people. They can't talk about it. And we're asking you, what are your financial taboos? What can you not talk about when it comes to money? And let's try some honesty. Are you willing to tell us how much you make? Mike emails us, if you're willing to tell It's not enough. Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about it in a few minutes. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama gets ready for another day of working on health care reform. He'll sit down with wavering House Democrats today. Meanwhile, advocacy groups are running ad campaigns in districts where Democratic lawmakers are thought to be on the fence. Five young Americans are being held in Pakistan, and they've been charged with planning terror attacks. The men, all Muslims from the Washington, D.C. area, have pleaded not guilty to the charges.
And police in Enfield, Connecticut, are looking for thieves who last night in a brazen warehouse raid made off with $75 million worth of Eli Lilly prescription drugs, mostly antidepressants. What does that mean? But the criminals needing that many antidepressants. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Check your credit report.
Do it yourself.
Manage money.
Your income tax.
Where's your bailout?
Saving for college.
Negotiate the best price.
Where's my haggle?
Start saving.
Retirement.
Bailout.
Do it yourself.
Where's your bailout?
Do it yourself.
So for the past year, we've heard a lot about bailouts, bailouts for the car industry, bailouts for the American financial system. The big banks got a bailout. What happened to our bailout? Who's going to come in and bail out the average American citizen? Takeaway contributor Beth Koblenzer has an answer to that question. You are going to bail yourself out. We have a new series that we start today called Do It Yourself Bailout. It's a 10-part series. And this week, the question is, why can't we talk about money? Why is it so hard to talk about personal finances? It's just plain difficult. Keeping silent may be more comfortable, but it's also perhaps not healthy and certainly not good for your finances. Beth Koblenzer is author of Get a Financial Life. She's here to help us break this silence. Also with us, Stephen Goldbart, a psychologist and co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
So Beth, first of all, let's kind of get an idea about this, because people come to you for answers, financial answers, right?
Right.
All the time. Are they agonized? I mean, what does it take to bring them to you?
Well, I think the main thing is we've all heard about this $11 trillion bailout. And I've been seeing people now wearing T-shirts saying, where's my bailout? And we see right now that there's 6 million Americans who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, which is the longest period since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been keeping this figure since 1948. So there's such a long period of time where people are out of work, and it's devastating for them. Meanwhile, they have $8,000 in credit card debt on average. One in four American homeowners are underwater, meaning they owe more than their home is worth. People have depleted their savings. And so we decided to do this takeaway bailout movement to get people up and learn about, you know, how to save. What are the secrets behind your credit score? How do you get out of debt? All those questions that you've asked me, everybody's asked me, and we're going to try to figure them out for people.
Okay, but Stephen, this is a question for you, because I was unemployed for just about 6 months. It was very, very difficult financially, and clearly I have a lot of house cleaning financially to do to recover from that, which I'm sure a lot of people are in that situation. And what I discovered when I started talking to my friends about this is that nobody wanted to talk about it. And when I finally did broach the subject, they were almost relieved to have a place to vent that. So what is this that makes us feel this personal shame over money issues?
Yeah, it's really true that money today is the issue that sex was maybe 50 years ago in terms of still being taboo and uncomfortable. And then when people just turn on the faucet, everyone's ready to just talk about it. That's because, in part, it's a lightning rod issue. Money is just loaded with emotional issues such as love, control, self-esteem, sexuality, and power. So it's very hard to have a conversation about money that's just about the money. People feel that when you ask them about money, you're asking them, you know, do you have or do you not have self-esteem? Have you made it? Are you likable? Are you dressed for success? You know, how well is your life going? In effect, in this country, money overdetermines, you know, who we are, our self-esteem, and what we are as people.
You know, Beth, I actually have a friend of mine who actually leaves her credit card bill sitting there until it's late because she doesn't want to open it, and she has the money to pay for it.
Yeah.
You must see people like this all the time.
Absolutely. You know, most people I know so little about it because they were never taught anything about it. But I have to say, personally, when I go to the doctor and I say I used to write for Money Magazine and the doctor says, oh, I love Money Magazine, I usually run the other way because I want my doctor to read JAMA. I don't want my doctor to read Money Magazine.
And I agree.
I find people who are passionate about their careers or their families, we all have such busy lives. We don't really have that much time to focus on our money. It's not really all that fun. And we're busy doing so many other things. And those who do have time, you know, people are frightened. It is really overwhelming and scary to focus in on this topic that we don't know much about.
My wife and I have discovered that when you do it, mm-hmm. though, when you actually do get into it,
right.
it's actually, there's so much to talk about and so much to do there. It can be a bonding mechanism. It can actually be helpful.
Absolutely. That's the point.
You got to get over the hurdle.
You got to get over the hurdle. And I think the way to do that is by just diving in there, small steps at a time, like anything else in life. You get into the nitty gritty, you figure it out. And by talking about it, you really get to the nuggets of what we need to do as a couple or as
here,
a family.
Here, honey, here are my receipts. That's what we do.
That sounds so romantic.
But Stephen, you know, how do you get people to get over this fear of admitting things, of giving, even if they go to somebody like Beth Koblenzer and they're trying to get their finances together, oftentimes I bet they don't even give her the whole story. They're embarrassed to tell her how bad they think things are. How do you get people over that?
Well, I think we first have to start by facing that we are uncomfortable with this and that work on separating our financial worth from our self-worth and say to ourselves, okay, you know, this is going to be hard, but I'm just going to take that first step to get started. You know, none of us have been taught to be emotionally intelligent about money, mm-hmm. and most of us have not been taught, you know, the financial basics, and the kind of holes that people find themselves in have a whole lot to do with the way in which our society has, you know, pressed us to buy, to purchase, to consume, but hasn't helped us understand what it means to manage our money. And another important point here, a conversation about money doesn't have to be boring. Ultimately, a conversation that you begin to have with yourself or with people in your life about money can be a conversation about what really matters to you most.
It's kind of 12-step-y
here. The values and the principles mm-hmm. that you want to have drive your life.
I'm John Hockenberry, and I bought an electric guitar in my 50s that I couldn't afford.
There we go. You said it. But also, I think a lot of it's about financial literacy. I often say to people, could you save $50 a month? They're like, no, I can't. It's impossible. I'm like, well, how about $2 a day? And they're like, oh, sure. Well, $2 a day. Of course I can. I'm like, well, you know what? If you can save $2 a day, you can save. You can even save $60 a month. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, that kind of click. You know, a British study found that 1 in 7 people would say they prefer to visit a dentist rather than see a financial planner. So I feel like we're at this point.
How does that make you
and that's
feel,
the Brits.
Beth?
Yeah. I know. I think we're at the point where people are afraid, but perhaps the silver lining in this terrible economic situation that many people are feeling, and it's, you know, it's very serious and very grave, is that it's forced a lot of people to come to terms with, I'm in this dire situation. How do I get out of it? How do I pay attention to these issues at this very difficult time? And where do I start?
Do you generally find when people come to you, Beth, that things are worse than they think they are? Or do people generally think of themselves that they're in worse financial shape, they're in better financial shape than they thought?
I think, you know, as a journalist, I talk to people of all different ranges. But I think people are more scared, and it's this big, scary, you know, hole that they don't even want to go at and look at. And then when they look at the specifics, they're like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, it takes 3 phone calls and just to get it in order. Of course, it takes many, many years to pay off this debt. But once I'm on track, it's a little less scarier than I thought.
Well, Madoff was still scary, though.
Totally.
I think we're missing out on a whole horror film genre here.
Indeed.
Beth Koblenzer is author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s, and of course, we're a Takeaway contributor. And thanks to Stephen Goldbart, psychologist and wealth consultant, co-director of the Money, Meaning, and Choices Institute. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a story to share with us about this, tell us, what do your personal finances do that you find is hardest to share about with other people? A listener in Portland posts on our site, thetakeaway.org, I find it difficult to discuss the fact that my husband and I are not in financial distress. I feel guilty for our good fortune, although it's partly due to our conservative spending and investments, but I never tell my friends how much we make. And Shannon in Brooklyn, Connecticut, emails, my husband went from making $53,000 in 2008 to bringing in less than $15,000 in 2009. That's due to our having to move cross-country so I could keep my job from Arizona to Massachusetts. The company he worked for decided they couldn't accommodate a job transfer. He's been tempted for a year to go to the exact same company that he left. They have a hiring freeze that's keeping him from hiring him back. Give us your story. This interesting story is behind money and why people don't explain. Sometimes it's complicated. Maybe that's why. 877-8-
53K to 15K. Ouch. That's
big.
A drop.
You can follow this entire series, a 10-part series, and see Beth's lists of tips for people who want to start getting themselves in order. You can check that out at our blog, thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.